Welcome back to the Damage Report. A new day, a new week, a new co-host. We're mixing things up. Normally, we start off the week with Francesca Fiorentini, our fantastic Mondays. It's gonna be a fantastic Friday instead. So Francesca will be here on Friday. She will be helping me sort through the garbage people of the week. So you can stay tuned for that later on. But we've got a special treat for you. For the first time as co-host of the Damage Report, journalist David Schuster joins us. David, how's it going?
John, great to be with you. I think Francesca's soon gonna realize what a horrible mistake she made to start the week.
Well, we'll have to check in with her and see how she does. But we're very excited to have you on, David. You've been, you've been working with TYT for some time. You produce awesome content for people who might not have seen it, although I'm sure most have. Could you give us a little idea of what you do?
Yeah, so there's this TYT channel called Rebel HQ. And what I do is I do a video, just about a video every day, where I sort of find a topic that sort of I find interesting and provide some clips and sort of show the video and then offer some analysis of it. Sometimes it's all reporting, sometimes it's a little bit of reporting and analysis. Lately, I've been doing a lot of stuff on police behaving badly to try to underscore the systemic problems we have with police in the United States. So Rebel HQ on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube, and all the various channels for TYT.
Oh, that's awesome. I love a good beat. Are you finding it difficult to find enough content of cops behaving badly to fill your days?
The challenge, I mean, there's so much police body camera that is now getting released literally every day. The challenge actually is to try to find the police body camera that's controversial, that sometimes police departments will release it. And obviously you wanna try to, you wanna try to catch it before it goes viral so that we can sort of talk about it and frame it ourselves. But sometimes police departments will put very bland descriptions of very controversial traffic stops. And so that seems to be the biggest trick, is wading through all the various videos and keeping track of all the local stories to make sure that we're identifying the right stuff.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And a little behind the scenes info. So Dave and I were talking briefly about Michael Shore, who we both know. So Rebel HQ has had several lives. Way back, it was Michael's channel for his show 2020 and some other content that he did. So it's an interesting evolution. Glad to see that you're over there now.
Yeah, and I've been following TYT for a long time. I worked with Cenk way back when he came to MSNBC after I had left, but I worked with him and Michael Schur at Current TV, and then I worked with Michael at Al Jazeera and I-24. And John, I've been following your stuff for a long time. So it is truly an honor to be with you on the Damage Report.
That's awesome. Well, I'm very excited to have you here, and I believe that we've got an awesome spicy rundown for you. So if you are out there, thank you everybody, regardless of whether you're watching on the members app, linear platforms, Twitch, YouTube, whatever. Are you on Twitter? I don't know, maybe you're watching there. Please hit the like button and share the stream so that people know that we're live as we go through this. And through the course of the next 90 minutes, we're gonna be talking about a bunch. New revelations about some of the behind the scenes goings on with the pandemic response under former President Trump. We've got a little bit better of an idea of maybe what's gonna end up in the infrastructure bill, what some of the red lines for progressive senators might be. The future of the Supreme Court, the eviction moratorium. Is Mike Pence eventually going to be killed by this movement that he seeks to lead? We've got all that and much more. And by the way, if you stick around for our last half hour, we almost never do this on Monday, but we will be giving you meanwhile in our news from around the globe. So you've got that to look forward to.
Can I offer one more tease? One more tease.
Of course.
And as you mentioned, we may get to Tucker Carlson. For people who know anything about my career, there was a time in my career about 10 years ago where I actually was friends with Tucker Carlson and substituted for him on his MSNBC show. So I've got some insights into, I think, what is driving Tucker Carlson to do the nonsensical stuff that he's doing now. But we'll talk about it.
That is gonna be fascinating. I can't wait. Okay, well, hopefully you can't wait either, but you're gonna have to because it's a little bit later on. Anyway, along the way, please, if you want to send us messages, comments, tweets, super chats, stuff like that, we'll be responding throughout, seeing what you're, what's going on out there in the audience. So feel free to do that. And with that, David, how do you say we jump at this news?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. We're finding out a little bit more about what was going on behind the scenes in the White House, in the federal government, as the pandemic began to rage across the country. And as seems to always be the case, it's coming about as a result of a book, this time written by some reporters at the Washington Post. So let's jump into some of what they've revealed, while acknowledging that as of today, at least, over 601,000 Americans have died in the pandemic. Well over, I believe, 33 million Americans have been infected by COVID. Many hospitalized, many experiencing the long haul COVID that so many are dealing with right now. So all of that is out there. Here is what's been going on. You might recall in the early weeks of the pandemic, we didn't know, is it gonna hit America? If so, how bad? Turned out it had already been here for months. But there were a few cases where we weren't sure if it was gonna be here, and Trump was very focused on the number of infected. And so apparently, in the early days of the pandemic, as White House officials debated whether to bring infected Americans home for care, like for instance from the Diamond Princess cruise ship, that was a big scandal early on, Donald Trump had a plan. His plan to suppress the numbers on US soil was, don't we have an island that we own, he said in the Situation Room? What about Guantanamo? You know, Guantanamo Bay. Seriously, aides were stunned because, you know, and when Trump brought it up a second time, they quickly scuttled the idea, worried about a backlash over quarantining American tourists on the same Caribbean base where the United States holds terrorism suspects. So I think we dodged a bullet there, David. What do you think?
Was there some merit to the idea? Jumpsuits down there, the orange jumpsuits are actually pretty comfortable and the floppy shoes are retrofitted. But no, I think this goes to show both how ignorant Donald Trump was, not only about how the pandemic spread and also basic science about why the coronavirus was getting to the proportions that it was, and how just isolating just a couple of tourists wasn't gonna make any difference, but also a fundamental misunderstanding about Guantanamo Bay. Clearly he had never been there, clearly he hadn't been briefed on what the conditions are like at Guantanamo Bay and why it's impossible for the military to house people who are not combatants at that facility. And the idea that you would be able to use this sort of Navy facility for anything other than what it's being used for now is nonsensical. So it strikes me as really, I mean, unfortunate on so many levels. And again, I mean, sure, there was a time when I guess Donald Trump would say, oh, we've only got 6 cases or we've only got 12 cases. But the fact of the matter is anybody who had a basic understanding of science would know, but those are just the ones that have been identified in order to do the, you have to sort of figure out, well, who have those people been in contact with? And then it increases exponentially the number of people that have been exposed and that are likely carrying this thing. And for Donald Trump, again, not to understand the basic science here is just remarkable.
Yeah. And I mean, we had to get used to that day by day during the pandemic. Now you might be wondering, is this his worst idea? I don't know, dude did want to nuke a hurricane and he did think a moat stocked with crocodiles on the border was a good idea. So this might not be his worst one, but pretty dreadful. I don't think the American people would have been a fan of it. But anyway, a little bit more. He at one point yelled, testing is killing me, in a phone call with Alex Azar back on March 18th. So this is very early. Like that's a couple of days into when TYT was had just entered into lockdown. He said, I'm going to lose the election because of testing. What idiot had the federal government do testing? Azar responded, do you mean Jared? Because Jared, like a week earlier, had taken control of the federal government's nationwide testing program. So look, we know that in his speeches, Trump became laser focused on slowing down the testing. And there was a lot of back and forth in the media about, is it fair to say that he's slowing it down? Is he just joking about it or whatever? But no, apparently behind the scenes, he somehow really thought that it wasn't the spread of COVID that could endanger his presidency, people getting sick, people dying and all of that. It was just the testing, identifying cases, that if we could just slow that down, then sure, all these people will die, but I guess we won't know about it. And that would somehow be better morally or strategically, pragmatically. I don't know, David, but he really from the very beginning was focused on that.
Well, and John, as you've identified in the past, it is so hard to try to get into the mind of Donald Trump. But if we take this and try to think, okay, what was Donald Trump really thinking? The idea was that he thought, well, as long as the numbers are staying low in terms of what we've identified, well, we can always, I suppose, chalk up the sicknesses, the deaths, the hospitals that are jammed to something else, that maybe it's the flu, or maybe it's a breakout, or maybe it's something that is unrelated to COVID. The idea that he would actually be able to think, you know, for any period of time that, oh, we just have to hide the numbers and everything's gonna be fine for me politically, is such a horrible miscalculation and so ridiculous. I mean, and again, at the time, we needed more testing in order to figure out, okay, who's got this disease? Who's got this virus? Who doesn't? so that we can contact trace, we can make sure that the right people are being hospitalized, so that we can spread out the pandemic so it's not a crush of people all at the hospital at once and it gives everybody a chance. But for Donald Trump to think, oh, this is pure politics, all I need to worry about is my election and let's just keep the numbers down and blame the states or blame something other than coronavirus. I mean, it's beyond like reprehensible. I mean, what was it like for you, John, in terms of did you go out and get a test or have family members who were getting tests? And how valuable was that information, those insights to you?
Well, look, I have actually never been tested for COVID. My wife and I stayed in our one room apartment for the first 9-10 months of the pandemic. So I wasn't interacting with anyone. I do have family members. Of course, I lost a family member during COVID. So the people living with them were tested. It was obviously so vital, especially early on, for people to start to get an idea of the scope of this thing, to potentially get them to believe, to understand that this is a threat. They do need to worry about it. Thinking that the testing itself is the enemy is so twisted. And we sort of, I guess because it's political analysis, we're trained to just glide past the, as you point out, like moral reprehensibility of this. This is appalling in moral terms for a guy that, so many evangelical Christians believe was like mandated by God to become president, that he doesn't give a damn if these people are dying. But just strategically, politically, it seems insane to me. Now, bear in mind, even with the testing eventually ramping up, there was a campaign that led to millions and millions of Americans believing that the numbers are fake. So I started the segment, David, by saying 601,000 Americans have died, and that's the official number. There are studies that believe that it's higher, but there's tons of Americans that don't believe it's that high, that think that that is a wild overestimation. Except briefly when talking about Fauci's culpability for something having to do with the lab leak, then it suddenly becomes a real number that he's responsible for. But outside of that, there are a lot of people that don't believe these numbers are real anyway, that hospitals were faking a lot of these deaths.
Well, first of all, I mean, my condolences on your family member who passed. I wasn't aware of that, and I'm sorry to hear it. I remember when our kids' school, right? And in the pandemic, they were sort of shutting things down. And there was a testing effort underway because we needed to know, for our kids' sake and for family members, okay, who in the school has gotten it? Have certain teachers gotten it? Have the kids gotten it? Should those families sort of isolate? Because there still was a time at the beginning of this when a lot of schools wanted to somehow stay open or go to some sort of hybrid or go to sort of remote and then go back into school. And I just can't even imagine, I mean, the anxiety in our family and families that I know over children and over people who have underlying health conditions and wanting to make sure that you can sort of keep that protective bubble. The idea that we wouldn't have any of that information, I mean, I think, with the information that we had, we were able to save some lives across the United States. But I agree. I mean, if Donald Trump had been successful and he had been able to stamp out the testing that was underway, I think you would be looking at, instead of 601,000 deaths, you might be looking at more than a million. And that gets to the number that the early scientists projected, that if we did nothing in this country, we were looking at more than a million deaths from the coronavirus pandemic. And people can believe whatever they want to believe, but the fact of the matter is there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of families who have suffered incalculably and will forever be horrified by this virus because of inaction, both at the federal level and also at the state and local levels. And to the extent somebody was trying to tamp out testing, I just find it sickening beyond, beyond words.
I could not agree more. Now let's move to some of the others involved in this. The revelations from the upcoming Washington Post book about the behind the scenes of the pandemic response is a severe indictment of Donald Trump, but not just Donald Trump. There are others that are referenced here. So you have Robert Kadlec, who apparently was at the time HHS emergency preparedness chief, and apparently one of those that Trump wanted to fire, but like tried to fire and then got bored briefly and then forgot that he tried to fire. It's amazing, White House. So he was involved in the initial purchase of 600 million masks. He took his plan in late March to Jared Kushner, who apparently exploded in anger, throwing his pen against the wall in frustration when he learned the masks wouldn't arrive until June. He held it, the HHS emergency preparedness chief, "You effing moron, we'll all be dead by June." And that's obviously amazing. But the thing is, like, if that indicates that Jared Kushner was really worried about this, then why are we only finding this out in a book, a year plus later? Why was Jared Kushner, who was in charge of virtually everything the government was doing over the last 4 years, why wasn't he more public about this? If he thought that masks were so important, where was that? I never heard Jared Kushner talk about how people need to be wearing masks, we need to be spreading masks and all of that.
That's a great question. And to me, this anecdote seems totally true, right? Because think about Jared Kushner. Some people, when they get mad, they would pound their fists or they'd throw a chair or they'd stomp against the wall. There's little sort of weenie Jared Kushner throwing a pen against the wall, raising his voice and saying, we're all gonna be dead by the, I mean, of course that fits Jared Kushner. And so, yeah, I'm sure he was, you know, I'm sure he was mad and maybe he was trying to say, well, I can't say this publicly because my father-in-law will go crazy if we talk about how much, you know, the problems that exist. But sure, in a meeting where Jared Kushner is responsible for some supply chains and supply lines and trying to make sure that we've got enough masks, enough equipment for him to be told, no, nothing's coming really until June. I could see him, you know, getting mad, and I could also see him getting mad in that very sort of unique Jared Kushner way.
Yeah, I could. And look, I feel for Jared a little bit. Like, he was blindsided by this thing because he was busy working very hard and diligently on achieving a peace in the Middle East. So, you know, it's like he's got a lot of irons in the fire, I guess.
Well, anyway, it's so charitable to Jared, because here's one thing about the COVID. If you remember, John, that he was in charge of, remember, he created this sort of special task force, but none of these people on this task force in the spring of 2020 actually had any experience in government supply chains. They didn't bother to go to the Pentagon. They didn't go to the various government agencies that are used to doing this thing. They just created the best minds that Jared Kushner knew, all these sort of young guys, but they didn't have the right experience. So it was a big fine that he created this task force, but they actually hurt themselves and hurt all of us by putting people on this task force who had no idea how the federal government worked.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And that was true in a lot of different areas of the federal government during the Trump years, but this was possibly the most damaging instance of that. Now, we also have the chief of staff to Vice President Mike Pence, Mark Short, who apparently pushed back against an HHS effort to send free masks to every American household in the response's early days, a step that some public health experts think would have depoliticized mask wearing, but which Short believed would unnecessarily alarm people. Several senior officials also compared masks to, quote, underwear on your face, with one remarking that they look like a training bra. I don't understand people. Has no one in this administration ever like sanded a piece of wood, painted a little bit? You wear masks to protect your lungs. That's what you do. It shouldn't be new to these people at 50 years old. The idea that sometimes you might have to wear a mask. If you're going scuba diving, like you wear a mask to protect yourself. It's not like, oh yeah, I really want to see that sea urchin, but I'd rather drown than put underwear on my face. It's so stupid. And these people were in charge, as you were just alluding to. Like, we are at risk because of their ignorance, vanity, and weakness.
I agree with you. And full disclosure here, I, you know, sometimes have this sort of claustrophobia thing with masks. I absolutely hate masks. I hate crowded elevators. I can do scuba diving, but not if the water's sort of too deep. So I get it. I get why people don't want to put this thing on your face and have to, you know, give the okay sign or whatever you do in scuba diving. It's so uncomfortable and I sweat and it's terrible. Even now, I'm gonna go inside and go to a restaurant or something. They want everybody to wear masks. I'm like, oh God, but I've been vaccinated. Okay. But you do it, right? Sometimes you have to do things that you don't want to do because you're a member of society and you want to protect your family members, your friends, members of your community. And that's, again, if the nation had been rallied to, hey, we're all in this together. We're all gonna have to do something that's gonna be uncomfortable. Or David Schuster, you're gonna have to wear a mask even though you're claustrophobic. Okay, but we're doing this for each other. If that had been the message, imagine how much more successful we might have been and been able to spread out all of this so that the hospitals were not overwhelmed and the death count would be lower. But there was never a point with this administration in which there was sort of a common theme of let's all rally around this together. Let's all join forces and do things that may be a little bit out of our comfort zone in order to save one another. And that's the difference in my view between, say, you know, they call the effort to get the vaccine the moonshot. No, everybody was working together to go to the moon. Everybody was working together in the United States in World War II to defeat the Nazis. We were not all working together to defeat the pandemic. And to me, that is just the worst thing about the record of the Trump administration and all of this.
Yep, and you're right. And it leaves me wondering, can we all work together ever again on any major challenge? Like, if something worse than the pandemic comes, will we be torn apart by Fox News and petty, vain men? I worry about that. Okay, everyone, we do have to take our first break, but we've got so much more coming up after this. We're gonna find out what might be the line some progressive senators won't cross when it comes to the infrastructure bill. We'll have all that and more after this. Okay, let's jump back into the news and see what's going on out there. We've got this possible bipartisan infrastructure deal, but what is gonna be included and what shouldn't be if it seeks to actually get the 60 votes it might need to pass a filibuster? We've got Bernie Sanders, who's gonna be talking about some of the things that are sort of red lines for him. Before we jump to Bernie though, I wanna ask you, David, I'm sure you've been following the back and forth, the negotiations, there are these different groups. Do you think that any of this is gonna happen, or is all of that gonna fail and we just go to reconciliation and see what can happen there?
That's a great question. It does feel like there's something different about the last couple of days and the number of senators who have joined this sort of bipartisan effort. I think it's now up to 22, 23, 11 Republicans. Mm-hmm. So it feels like this round of negotiations is a bit different, but I think ultimately, there's gonna be a snag, whether it's over, you know, taxing gasoline or whatever it is. And I at a certain point, and I'm an optimist more than a pessimist, I'm optimistic that at a certain point, Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema are gonna say, this isn't working. Of course we're gonna have to use, you know, we're gonna have to bust the filibuster for this and use reconciliation. But, and I've got a lot of people say, oh, Schuster, you're a fool. Manchin and Sinema are the devil incarnate, and you know, this is just headed for disaster. And I get it. I get why people say that.
We'll see. Well, I don't believe in the devil. I do believe they're awful, but you're not a fool. They are awful though. Anyway, okay, so let's see some of what you were referencing there. So one of the bipartisan deals includes new fees for the purchase of electric vehicles, which is just great in a time of climate change, and raising the gas tax, sort of tying it into inflation to help pay for the bill, rather than raising the corporate tax rate, the tax rates on highest income individuals, to not even necessarily where they were when Trump became president, just sort of inching it back up there. No, let's get that out of there. Let's instead tax the EVs, tax gas. So here is what Bernie Sanders has to say about that.
Are you comfortable with a two-step process where you do, you noted this is the 25% about of what President Biden asked for? Is it worth it in your mind to take what you can get in a bipartisan way, especially if that's the way you can get Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to get on board a Democrats only bill that may tackle the care economy as you just outlined?
Well, look, as I said, what is in the bipartisan bill in terms of spending is, from what I can see, mostly good. It is roads and bridges, and we need to do that. That is what we are proposing in our legislation, but in much greater numbers. One of the concerns that I do have about the bipartisan bill is how they are going to pay for their proposals, and they're not clear yet. I don't know that they even know yet, but some of the speculation is raising a gas tax, which I don't support, a fee on electric vehicles, privatization of infrastructure. Those are proposals that I would not support.
David, depending on how big of a bipartisan group they put together, how many Republicans they're able to get, I guess it's conceivable that they could afford to lose Bernie Sanders, or maybe if Merkley was to say no for the same reason. It seems increasingly difficult considering how hard it is to get Republicans to sign on to virtually anything. So if they draw this as the line, it's about the funding, we're not gonna do it in this way. How much do you think that damages the bipartisan effort here?
I actually don't think it damages it that much, because if there is this agreement on sort of the nuts and bolts of what's in it, what are we gonna spend the money on? The roads and bridges, maybe we're not gonna spend so much on, you know, high tech stuff, whatever. If there's an agreement on sort of the size of the package and what you're spending on with the roads and bridges, how you pay for things, you can be far more creative. So let's just say, well, maybe, you know, to try to appeal to Bernie Sanders, you know, the gas tax maybe is only a penny, or maybe it's a nickel for every 5 gallons or whatever it is. Or maybe instead of the corporate tax rate going from, you know, 15 or 18 to 28 or whatever it is the Democrats want, maybe it goes up to 22 or 23. And oh, by the way, maybe you don't pay for part of this. In other words, you just tack it on to the deficit, to the debt, as we would do if this was a war, or as we did with the pandemic and all the expenses related to COVID-19. So there are a lot of different creative ways in terms of figuring out, well, maybe we pay for it this way, or we pay for just part of it and we just tack it up to the debt, and you're able to cobble together enough people. You don't worry the people, the deficit hawks. Maybe you get a few of them who suddenly, well, they'll leave because the deficit's gonna go up. But maybe you are able to keep a couple progressives who see the gas tax is not that draconian. So I just feel like there's more room in terms of negotiating a how you pay for this or don't pay for this. There's a lot of different creative ways they can do it than actually, you know, as long as there's a sort of agreement on the overall size and what this money's gonna be spent on. Again, I think I'm optimistic that they can get there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that you're speaking a lot of sense, which makes me think they're probably not gonna take a lot of your advice there. Like, yeah. It is one of the weird ironies of American politics that like building a road costs money, but blowing it up's free. It's like on the house, you don't have to pay for it. I don't know why that is. And look, obviously the devil is in the details. You know, what would the raise in the gas tax actually look like? I don't know. And by the way, we've talked about this a couple times over the past week or two, and I've gotten a lot of messages from, I think, good-meaning progressives who are like, well, you know, in a lot of countries, they do raise the gas tax to disincentivize either, you know, personal transport vehicle cars, or literally to try to push people away from internal combustion engines to EVs. And let me tell you, I totally get that. And on some level, there's nothing I care more about than trying to fight back against climate change. That said, it is a regressive tax. And in particular, in terms of the framing, when it's being proposed, not just out of the blue, but specifically as a replacement for raising the corporate tax rate, raising the highest marginal tax rate, then like that is going to trigger, like we all have multiple competing values. Fighting climate change is certainly one of mine. Not sticking it to the working class at literally every opportunity is another one. So it's a difficult situation. And Bernie Sanders, I think, is trying to work through that. Really fast, David, one part that Bernie didn't seem to respond to, but was part of Chuck Todd's question, which was the two-step thing, which is you do this bipartisan thing where maybe they strip away a bunch of the climate change fighting measures, and then you come back to try to do that. I have some anxiety about how that would work or how likely it is. What do you think about the possibility of coming back and doing some of the other non-hardcore physical infrastructure stuff in a second bill?
John, your anxieties are well placed, because if they kick that can down the road, they will not get to it. Maybe they'll have some hearings, maybe they'll have some negotiations, but the only thing that will pass will be this sort of first step. So I think Democrats, progressives have to be very careful about not giving away things under some sort of promise. Oh yeah, we'll circle back to that. Like, we'll circle back to climate change. We'll circle back to somehow helping electric vehicles. No, you won't circle back, because the Senate has such a difficult time passing anything anyway. So Democrats, Kristen Sinema, Joe Manchin, they should beware, and progressives too. You're gonna get what you're gonna get the first time you pass something. You're not gonna get anything more. If you wanna try to figure out, if you wanna separate and say, well, we're gonna spend, you know, $750 billion on this infrastructure, and then we'll circle back to how we pay for it later, that's fine. Because I don't care whether all that money gets added to the debt if you don't pass anything in terms of how you pay for it. But in terms of what the money is actually spent on, no, I think Democrats should be very careful. Get what you can get right off the bat. Don't give that up. If you want to give up something, give up on the spending side in terms of how you pay for it.
Yeah, no, I think that you're totally right. Like, we have such a narrow window. Like, you know, elections are, you know, interminably long in the United States. And at some point, we're gonna pass that invisible marker that now we're in the midterms, and goodbye, Irene, on literally anything being done. Honestly, and Bernie didn't imply that he thinks that that's likely to work here, but one of the few times I've actually been able to speak to him, we interviewed him about the COVID aid bill. And I asked him about this talk about, well, you know, get what you can under Biden now in the early days, and then they're saying they'll do a second COVID aid bill later on. Does he think that's likely? And he said that he thought there was a good chance. I don't even hear that being talked about now. Another, like, maybe tying in a little bit of funding to one of the other bills, but there's no push for a big COVID related economic or public health relief bill. Not that I've been seeing anyway.
Yeah, and so smart of you, John, in your show to focus on what Bernie Sanders said at Meet the Press, because I really do think he's something of a weather vane in terms of where the Democrats are and where the red line is. And if Bernie Sanders is saying, no, you better not go with gas taxes, that's a signal that there are others in his mind, I think, as well, that won't go for it. And if Bernie Sanders is saying we're okay with the parameters of a smaller bill and it's going to pay for largely bridges and tunnels and roads, I think that's also a pretty good weather vane. So there's a lot there to take into consideration in terms of what Bernie Sanders is putting out there. But again, also some warning bells about the things that he's not talking about, such as you know, more COVID relief and more aid.
Yeah. Well, let's test the weather vane hypothesis as we move into an area where Bernie is very much disagreeing with some other progressives. there's been a push on the internet in interviews for Justice Breyer to preemptively retire from the SCOTUS. People are burned by what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They're worried about what might happen if he waits too long to leave. So people have been asked about this. Bernie Sanders was asked about this, and here is what he had to say.
Do you think this pressure campaign is appropriate? And would you like to see him retire now?
No, I will let the judge make his own decision. I'm not gonna tell him what to do.
And that was it, actually. Like, he was just, not only is he not interested in pressuring him, he wasn't really interested, David, in talking about the topic. You know, bear in mind, we've had Representative Mondaire Jones was saying it's time. AOC was asked about it. She wasn't just like spontaneously giving a speech about it, but she was asked about it and she said, I would encourage him to. She said, I would lean in that direction. Bernie was just not having it. What are your thoughts about this? Should they be pressuring him? Does it have any chance of succeeding?
I don't think it has any chance of succeeding. And here's why. Maybe Bernie Sanders, because of his age, is able to sort of relate a little bit more to people saying you should hang it up. I mean, Justice Breyer is 82. He's going to be 83 in August. In terms of the calendar, in terms of when he really could pose a danger with, say, you know, let's suppose Republicans take control of the Senate. And even though Joe Biden is president and Mitch McConnell says, all right, Republicans take control of the Senate, then there's no chance we're going to confirm a replacement for somebody like Breyer. Well, under that calendar, you still have until literally the end of 2022. So my suggestion, and certainly the Supreme Court term, where Justice Breyer has already okayed a couple of big cases in the next term, a big case on abortion, a big case on gun control. Yeah, I can envision a scenario, and I've heard some chatter in legal circles in Washington, D.C., where Justice Breyer has signaled, look, I want one more term in the spring of 2022. You know, 5 or 6 months before the election, yes, I will then resign. 5 or 6 months is plenty of time to propose a new justice, get a justice confirmed, and on the bench before the 2022 election. So, yes, I do hope that Justice Breyer gets off the court in time for his replacement to be named before the end of 2022. But I think he's got a little bit more time. And I think backing off, he knows what the stakes are. He knows what happens with what happened with Justice Ginsburg being replaced. In the way that she was replaced by Amy Coney Barrett, he gets it. And I know all the chatter, he hears it. But I do think Bernie's got a point about, you know, let's give him a little breathing space. Let's give everybody a little bit of time to figure this out. And let's count on Justice Breyer doing the right thing a year from now, as opposed to having to do it right now.
Yeah, you might be onto something. I think 5 to 6 months probably is enough time, assuming the Democrats maintain control. Obviously, if anything happens, if some senator gets sick and has to resign, is replaced by a Republican.
Well, that is a great point, John, because that's the catch here, right? Let's suppose Justice Breyer is going to assume that Democrats maintain control till the end of 2022 or till the 2022 midterms. But what happens if a senator gets sick and has to leave? And then you have to look at, well, you know, what are the replacement rules? Is there a possibility that a Democratic senator leaves the Senate and gets replaced by a Republican or a special election? Yes. And that is a big danger in this. I don't think it's the ultimate danger, but that is something to consider.
Yeah, yeah. So let's throw out a few more opinions on this, and then I have one additional question. So Senator Sheldon Whitehouse recently said that now would be the right time for Breyer to retire, given what Mitch McConnell has said about blocking, you know, any nominee if they take over in 2024 and 2023. I got news for you: if they were in charge today, it'd be over. There'd be no chance. But anyway. Whitehouse did say, I don't know that senators trying to tell you what to do makes that decision easier rather than harder. And there was a report in the Boston Globe. Breyer said he was worried about public misperceptions of justices as junior level politicians. This is last April. During a 2-hour lecture at Harvard Law School, he expressed a deep fear that the nation's highest court could lose public trust if its members are seen to be guided by politics. And I get that philosophically. And, you know, timing your retirement to benefit one party rather than another is certainly a way that people do that, but it's not a new thing. It's not like if he does it, oh, now that's a thing. that is definitely a thing. Choosing justices is 100% a political process that has been manipulated by an ever increasing amount of partisanship. Like the Mitch McConnell has fundamentally, I think, changed the rules. He can reference the 1880s all he wants. He has set the rules for this going forward. And I think the most important point is the point you made, that regardless of what we think he should do, calling for it probably isn't going to influence the outcome. So maybe there's no point in it anyway. I'm very worried about something happening. And then even if, you know, like, let's say that he retires and we have those 5 to 6 months, are we 100% sure that Joe Manchin and Sinema aren't gonna try to use their newfound power, not necessarily to sink it as they are with legislation, but to have a huge amount of influence over who the nominee is gonna be, potentially dragging on the process? I don't know, David, do you worry about that?
Here's the good news in all this, John, that I think there's plenty of room for people who are worried, and I count myself among those who are worried, but I think there's plenty of room for people to say, hey, Justice Breyer on a step down. We did a video about that on Rebel HQ and the dangers. I think it's fine for those videos, for the commentary, for the pressure to be out there. I also think it's fine if Justice Breyer wants to say, hey, I want a little bit more time. I'm gonna give this another Supreme Court term and we'll see how things go. Everybody can express what they want. He's a grown man, gonna be 83 years old. He's been on the court a long time. He has seen a lot. I'm sure he can handle the pressure. It may not influence him at all, but that's okay. He can take it. And so I think people should feel free to say what they want.
Okay. Well, you know, if you know the justice, feel free to share this video with him. We'll see what he thinks.
I don't know him, so I can't help you with that. I'm sure he's aware.
I'm sure somebody watching this must have. Anyway, okay. With that, we are gonna take our second break. When we come back, the federal eviction moratorium is, I mean, it's just a couple of weeks till that thing goes away. So what's potentially at stake? What could potentially be done? We're gonna be breaking those things down after this. Okay, everyone, let's jump back into some news. For some time now, there has been a national moratorium on evictions, which has helped stop potentially millions of people from being thrown out of their apartments, thrown out of their homes. Well, that is set to expire on June 30th. It's coming up in just a couple of weeks. Through the course of this last year, more than 7 million homeowners took advantage of the foreclosure moratorium passed as part of the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act last spring. This is very big. As of right now, it is believed, and estimates very much vary, that more than 2 million homeowners are behind on their mortgages and risk being forced out of their homes in just a matter of weeks. It's according to Harvard University. Over 10 million US adults, 14% of all the renters in the United States, are still behind on rent, with renters of color and renters with children affected disproportionately. And so, if nothing is done nationally at least, this could be a massive disaster. Now, bear in mind, some states have eviction moratoriums, foreclosure moratoriums, but that is obviously going to vary depending on what area you live in. Nationally, it's potentially a disaster. And we can't really be too surprised by this because it's not like the debt disappeared. Now, it was very helpful for people to be able to stay in their homes, especially amidst a pandemic. But that stuff was still, that was just piling up over that time. So without some sort of massive help, no matter how far you push back the date, it seems like you've got a disaster looming, David. And this is something that people have been talking about from the early days of the pandemic. I'm wondering when we're finally as a nation going to grapple with the fundamental problems.
And that's, look, I was just reading the other day about, was it BlackRock, which is buying up all these various sort of properties and making life very difficult for people who now, you know, can't, by buying up the properties, they're making them more expensive for people who actually do want to buy them. And BlackRock, of course, is going to rent them and is buying up entire communities. And so I think that this is a terrible, terrible time right now to be forcing people to, you know, pony up the money that they owe or be evicted. And I would, you know, I would say, let's kick this can down the road. I don't know, for 5 years, if that's what it takes, if we're not ready as a nation to deal with the structural flaws that involve particularly, you know, lower income minorities and women, people who are generally more often gonna be renters, if we can't deal with those structural inequalities and problems, then let's just keep kicking this down the road, right? Because they should go hand in hand. If we're ready right now to say, you know what, we're going to deal with the structural flaws and problems involving rent and the aggressive behavior and the egregious behavior by people who own these buildings and on and on and landlords, then okay, fine. Then maybe we can set a date for when we should end the moratoriums. But until we're willing to tackle one, I don't think we should be tackling the other.
Yeah. And I definitely think the worst option is just at some point it's gone. You now have this massive bill that pre-pandemic nobody could have paid for. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the stats of the percentage of Americans that like a $400 surprise bill would economically break them. Well, now some of them are looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. So I agree, postponing it at least is very important to allow people to get back on their feet. There's still a lot of people out of work. Hypothetically, the US government could buy up the debt and either pay it down, cancel it, or potentially offer some sort of extremely low interest or no interest way for people to pay it back. That's a possibility. Now, some people might say, well, why would the government buy it up? There's a case to be made that the government is responsible for a lot of this debt. If the government had taken the pandemic more seriously, the economy could have theoretically opened back up. People would have been able to work. They might not be in as much debt if the government hadn't been so fundamentally irresponsible. And I worry that the narrative coming out of this is that it's the people who are irresponsible. We already see all this stuff about people being so lazy that because they're getting the unemployment, they're not going back to work. Like, I'm sure they can identify a few people that applies to. But if there was irresponsibility, it was the government and large sections of the media last year that were truly irresponsible in a way that had a huge cost both in lives and dollars. Oh, sorry, jump in.
No, I was gonna say, well, even if somebody really wants to believe, and I don't, but even if somebody out there in the audience says, oh no, but people are irresponsible. Well, okay, I seem to remember, I think it was back in 2008, 2009 during the financial crisis where we identified mega traders on Wall Street who rang up trillions of dollars in terrible deals. We forgave them, the government bailed them all out. So if we're gonna bail out the financial industry and bail out all of those fat cats for their irresponsibility, well, why can't we bail out, the folks on Main Street who are saying, you know what, through no fault of my own, I've gotten something of a hole. Maybe instead of completely bailing them out, maybe we, give them, say, pay 10% on every, $100 that you owe and make some sort of good faith gesture. I mean, there are different ways to do this without forcing people to get out of their homes. And I think a little more creativity, a little more empathy towards people would actually go a long way, both in recouping some of this money, but also figuring out some way that we can solve this.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm glad that you brought up BlackRock and some of these other groups that are buying up so much real estate, because we've really got I feel like the renters and the people with their mortgages are about to be crushed between these two behemoths. So you have these companies that have been buying up all this real estate, and that is causing problems just for people trying to buy right now. But then you have these interests that want to end the moratorium as soon as possible. So why? I mean, you might have landlords that are pushing for it because they want to get paid. Okay, I understand that. But there are some huge organizations that are trying to do this. And think about the effect of that. In theory, it's too early for millions of homeowners. Many of those homeowners will lose their homes. Who will get those homes? Well, potentially some of these massive organizations like BlackRock. So I want to give credit to Perez and Sirota, the Daily Poster, David Sirota, who's been on the show a number of times. He had reporting back in May about some different organizations that have been pushing for the moratorium to be prematurely ended. So throughout the first half of this year, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the Pacific Legal Foundation, and the New Civil Rights Alliance have been pushing, I love the names for organizations in this country, have been pushing federal courts to strike down the CDC's eviction moratorium. The group has so far won 2 rulings. So here are details on those. In February, the Texas Public Policy Foundation convinced a federal judge in Texas to declare the CDC's eviction moratorium unconstitutional. In March, a federal judge in Ohio sided with the Pacific Legal Foundation, ruling that the CDC exceeded the scope of its authority with its eviction ban. Now, obviously, there are a number of wealthy, interesting groups that fund groups like this. One of those, though, is the Charles Koch Foundation, which between 2017 and 2019 contributed almost $7.7 million to those three organizations, according to the foundation's tax returns. And so, it's not just, it's time. They've exceeded their legal authority. There is potentially a huge amount of money to be made in doing whatever's necessary to get people kicked out as soon as possible. I mean, I'm sure they want to recoup the money, But there's also potentially homes on the line here. So I think that's something that people need to bear in mind.
Look, I'm right there with you. I mean, and look, I get the argument that some people have who say, look, I made my, you know, last year when I was when we were, you know, had an apartment in New York and we had a place in Connecticut and we were having to pay double rent because we just decided to leave, and we stayed up to date on all of our payments. And I get the theory or the feeling that some people have about, well, shouldn't I be rewarded if I do stay up to date? And the fact of the matter is, we're already rewarded. Those of us who have been staying up to date, your credit is better. It's easier to borrow money. It's easier to put down money for a house. There's all sorts of benefits that people already get by paying their rent on time. So this argument that, well, we should just punish these people because they didn't do it. No, you shouldn't punish them. You should try to help them, and you should try to take stock of the fact that if you are one of those lucky people who have been making your payments on time, congratulations, you're doing better than a lot of people.
Yeah, you're totally right. It's like, it's, you know, applied to this, it's a version of the argument that people make reacting to that we can't cancel student loan debt because I already paid mine off. Yeah, you're totally right. It applies in this case as well. Okay, we only have a few minutes, but really fast, I want to cover this last story. And then after the break, we're going to have a lot more, obviously. Mike Pence holds such an interesting position on the right now, narrowly avoiding potentially being strung up on January 6th with an insane mob that attacked the Capitol. Well, now he's being heckled. He was at the Faith and Freedom Coalition Summit, and here's how his speech went.
It is great to be back with so many patriots dedicated to faith and freedom and the road to the majority. And I want to thank my friend Ralph for those overly generous words. I'm deeply humbled by them. Ralph Reed knows me well enough to know the introduction I prefer is a little bit shorter. I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order, and I am honored to stand before you today.
Stop using that line. God, I'm sick of that line. Anyway, they were yelling traitor at him. Even though he stood loyally by Donald Trump for year after year, he's a crazy right winger. Like, he's totally their people, but he didn't overthrow the election with powers he doesn't have. So, David, I'm curious, is there any way that he gets back into the good graces of that party? Or is the dissent being overplayed?
That's such a great question. So first of all, I'm from Indiana. I remember when Mike Pence was governor, my parents would talk about what a terrible governor he was. I thought that he was a terrible vice president. But I would never stand up and say traitor at Mike Pence. I'd be a little bit more respectful. So I think that goes to show just how crazy some of the people in the lunatic far right really are regarding Mike Pence. And I don't think that there's much hope for Mike Pence at this point, because he does carry, whether it's fair or not, he does carry some of that baggage of being seen as, well, he wanted the wheels of democracy to keep rolling, and he was therefore willing to authenticate the election. And there's enough Republicans out there who see that as some sort of betrayal, even though Pence was operating within the Constitution, and I'll give him credit for that. But there are enough Republicans that are out there who consider that to have a certain sort of stink factor. And so I think for somebody like, you know, the Florida governor or somebody else who doesn't have that same sort of burden, DeSantis, for somebody who doesn't have that same sort of burden, I think it's easier in a certain way for them to appeal to the far right fringe, because they don't have to talk about their role during the election, and they can be just as conservative as Mike Pence and not have that baggage weighing them down.
Yeah, you're probably right. And there was one of the straw polls, I think, at the Western Conservative Values, whatever, just a couple of days ago, DeSantis actually narrowly beat Trump in approval for running for president in the coming next election. I think you're right. The thing that it bothers me, I wonder if it bothers Mike Pence, is that Donald Trump spent weeks telling people that Mike Pence could save them, and didn't, obviously, because he didn't have the power. He could stop this. He could stop the calls of traitor. He could speak out in support of his vice president, but he's not actually doing that. And I wonder if that bothers Mike Pence after all of his loyalty, that Donald Trump has effectively like washed his hands of Mike Pence. So I don't know what becomes of him. It doesn't seem like he'd pick him to be his VP when he runs again, but I don't know. Perhaps we'll all be surprised.
I gotta believe that it does bother Mike Pence, but maybe he's got such a disciplined view of the long view, the long game in all this, that Mike Pence doesn't want to engage in all this. He's just gonna take it in hopes that somehow that keeps him above the fray. But I gotta believe, John, possible, that it gets under his skin. At least I'd hope so.
That is certainly possible. Unfortunately, that is all the time we're going to have for this first hour. So if you've been watching on the linear platform, thank you very much for that. If you're watching on YouTube, the members app, Twitch, we will have some more stories for you, including Meanwhile In. I did want to let you know that the Twitch pitch final call is done. But if you tune into the Young Turks later on today, they're actually going to announce the semifinalists. So that's going to be a lot of fun, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 3 p.m. Pacific time to see that announced. Early heads up that Indisputable will of course be coming after the damage report today. So when the show's done, prepare for that. And we'll have more for you after this. Welcome back everyone to the Damage Report with me, Johnny Derulo, and David Schuster for the first time. David, thank you again for joining us. I'm sure you're
John, I'm having a riot. This is awesome.
I've had a lot of fun. You have a lot of experience and it shows. and I appreciate that. What you might appreciate coming up is a live event, like with people in the same room. It's crazy, but I think it might work. It's the Economic Justice Town Hall that Cenk Uygur is gonna be doing with Killer Mike and Senator Nina Turner coming to a Cincinnati near you. It's coming up in the very near future, June 26th actually. They're gonna be talking about Medicare for all, getting a living wage, other progressive policies, the topic of economic justice. If you want information about that and potentially want to visit, you can go to tyt.com/events. You'll find out more information and including when tickets will be on sale. So yeah, got that coming. Well, with that, why don't we jump back into the news a little bit before we take a tour around the globe. First, let's talk about Tucker Carlson. Yeah. Everyone's favorite time of the day. Tucker Carlson might have you believe that he's not a big fan of the media. He's previously called them animals and cowards just in April. Says, I just can't overstate how disgusted I am, not simply by the details of the lying of the medium, but disgusted by the emphasis. The media is basically Praetorian guard for the ruling class. I really hate them for it, I'll be honest. Now, this segment is about how potentially maybe he's feigning a bit of his hatred for the media. Later, we'll go back to focusing on how he's feigning his hatred for the ruling class. But for now, let's focus on the media. And bear in mind, we have with us David. You know Tucker Carlson, or at least did. Yeah. I've never met the man. I don't know him. So we have a different perspective in that way. But what we've got here is a lot of people coming out and saying, no, dude loves to gossip with the media, actually. He loves to frame things his way, play stories and things like that. So this is Ben Smith from the New York Times says, Mr. Carlson spends his time when he's not denouncing the liberal media, trading gossip with them. He's the go-to guy for sometimes unflattering stories about Donald J. Trump and for coverage of the internal politics of Fox News, not to mention stories about Mr. Carlson himself. I won't talk here about any off the record conversations I may have had with him, but 16 other journalists, none from the Times, it would put my colleagues in a weird position if I asked them, told me on background that he has been, as three of them put it, a great source. Michael Wolff called him a primary super secret source. I don't even know what that means, but anyway, so he rails against the media quite often, pitching them as either snitches or stenographers for the status quo, which I largely agree with, but probably not on the same story as he would. And that sort of thing, purveyors of cancel culture and all that. But he seems to like gossiping with them. What are your thoughts?
A couple of things. So yes, I do believe that Tucker Carlson does hate certain members of the media. We all do. We all have people in the media that we think are terrible. We all, whether you're a police officer or a teacher, there are bad apples in every bunch. My relationship with Tucker Carlson goes back a ways. So Tucker Carlson worked at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette newspaper in the early 1990s. I was a television reporter at the ABC affiliate there in the mid 1990s. We shared anecdotes on the 2000 campaign of the John McCain bus. So I got to know him then. He goes to NBC, I went to MSNBC, I would substitute for his show, 2007-2008. To me, he was always a really nice guy off camera, and even on camera, we would have our disagreements, but he was always respectful. But the one thing that really stood out to me is that when I got in a little bit of trouble with Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton, and it was a long story, Google David Schuster pimped out if you want all the background, but I ended up on the front page of the New York Post, pimped out reporter gets suspended. And I've been, I see my career going up in flames at MSNBC. I'm suspended for 2 weeks. I don't know, my parents are asking me, what is this all about? And there I am on the front page of the New York Post. Tucker Carlson comes up and says, Schuster, this is the best thing that has ever happened to you. This is great. Go out and collect every New York Post you could possibly can, save them. This is terrific for you, Schuster. And I'm thinking, really? And so, but that to me was his sort of view, the idea that you are the news, that you are the one that everybody is talking about. You now have a reputation as a ball buster, whatever it is. He thought that was awesome. And to me, it got to sort of my overall view of how Tucker has evolved over the last now 12, 13 years. And again, it's been 6 or 7 years since I've actually had a conversation with him. I think this really is a game to him. I think he knows that as long as he's feeding this stuff out to the masses and he's controversial and he's saying crazy things, I don't think he really believes most of the stuff that he's putting out there, but he knows it gets a huge audience. He knows how to play the conservative game better than anybody, as the ratings on Fox News for him show. And so he just keeps feeding it out there. And he does take some umbrage and some frustration with some of the journalists who are lazier people, who are not sort of the more sort of pure. If you're going to be a journalist, be a pure journalist. If you're going to be an opinion pundit, be a pundit. And I think he does take some issue with people who cross the line. But again, to me, this is just a game for him, and he's playing it really well. Would I play that game? No, I couldn't pull it off the way he pulls it off, because to me, it's inauthentic. But Tucker Carlson has a way of understanding. He embraces that he is the story. He embraces that he is creating this narrative about Republicans and about Democrats, and he loves it. And so that's just my view in terms of how this has all evolved. I think it's dangerous, and I would say that to him if I had my next conversation with him. But to me, that's what's going on.
I think that you're probably right about his motivations, and especially like you can afford to do that when you're independently wealthy and all that. You don't even need to succeed necessarily, even though he is. And by the way, I hate that impulse. The idea that the person delivering the news is the point of the news. I hate that. I've often told the audience that if you find at some point, if you can reflect and say, wow, after watching John and the Damage Report for a long time, I believe that politics is about watching John and the Damage Report, then please leave while you can, because I've ruined you. That's not the point of this. Yeah. But anyway, it definitely does seem like he has changed over time, potentially some politically, but even just like you talked about him being even on air, he's very respectful. I definitely wouldn't describe him these days as respectful to those he disagrees with. Like, absolutely, it is a pretty absolute thing. I think,
yeah, you're right. He has evolved very sharply on that over the last 6 or 7 years, I would say, for sure.
It's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Iran, they've got a new leader too. It's happening all over the place. Ibrahim Raisi, a hardline judge who's currently under US sanctions for human rights abuses, secured a landslide victory on Saturday in Iran's presidential election after a contest marked by voter apathy. Hey, they're just like us, over economic hardships and political restrictions. A little bit of information about Raisi, said to have been part of a so-called death committee, one of four judges who oversaw secret death sentences for about 5,000 prisoners in jails near Tehran. It says the location of the mass graves, according to Amnesty International, where the men and women were buried, is being systematically concealed by the Iranian authorities. And as we pointed out, participation in the election was very low at 48.8%, or, you know, like standard US participation. More than 70% actually voted back in 2017. So, like, you know, the United States is saying there's concerns about the actual fairness of the election. That could be entirely true. I generally don't automatically accept the US pitch of which elections are legitimate and which are not. I feel like we've gotten it wrong a few times. But that said, David, we've got a new leader in Iran, as Biden is, you know, potentially looking to restart some sort of diplomatic relationship there. What do you think about this development? Does that make the job any easier, any harder?
You know what? In some ways, I think it makes it easier, because and regarding the elections and whether it was clean or not, the reality is he is the new leader of Iran. He still has to report to the Grand Ayatollah. So you could argue that the Grand Ayatollah is the one who really sort of controls the presidency. But in any case, the fact that they have decided, whether through democracy or through representative, through voting or through the Grand Ayatollah, that they want a hardliner in place, I think it makes it a little bit more predictable now for the Biden administration, that they understand that there are going to be certain red lines, there are going to be certain issues where the Biden administration is going to have a very difficult time. Ironically, it hasn't stopped some progress being made in Vienna in terms of negotiations with US negotiators and Iranian negotiators over a new sort of nuclear deal. So it may be that there's flexibility on The Iran and the United States re-entering a nuclear deal, but maybe there's no flexibility in terms of how Iran treats its own sort of dissidents, its own people within Iran, or even its sort of funneling of missiles and arms to Hezbollah and others across the Middle East. Maybe there's no stopping it, but at least now the Biden administration has a very clear view on who they're dealing with. And sometimes I think that can make negotiating easier, even if the outcome still remains pretty difficult.
Yeah, and for people who are watching this that are thinking, well, you know, I want to make sure that we have some sort of influence that we can push for, you know, increased concerns for human rights and all of that. Well, we need to have a relationship if we're going to do that. And supposedly Raisi says he's going to remain committed to the deal, wants to get the sanctions removed. What's interesting in this case, so that's all good news and expected. I'm a little bit more worried about US-based hardliners when it comes to the future of this deal, because trying to reestablish the status quo diplomatically that we had before Donald Trump, that seems like a reasonable thing to do. But I imagine many Republicans, especially those gearing up for the midterms, those who are thinking about potentially running for president, are going to take any attempt to reestablish diplomacy with Iran as unacceptable and attack Biden accordingly. I think that's a pretty safe prediction, correct?
Yeah, and that's a great point too, because you'll see these hardliners in the United States will see, aha, they appointed a conservative hardliner in Iran. So why on earth would the Biden administration want to negotiate with them when look who they've just made their president? Sure, there'll be people in the United States, the domestic political audience, who will take this and run with it. But I also think that in the long run for the Biden administration, it's not going to change much. The United States is still not going to have any influence over domestic affairs within Iran. They're not going to be able to stop Iran's influence across much of the Middle East. Maybe this gives the Biden administration a little bit more in terms of what they can expect with the nuclear deal. But to your point, I mean, Iran has been a disappointment in terms of the US relationship with Iran has been a disappointment for a long time. And I'm not sure anything really changes here.
Yeah, potentially. Meanwhile, in Japan, the Olympics are coming. Is a new surge of COVID coming too? Well, a member of Uganda's Olympic team tested positive for COVID-19 in Japan after getting the AstraZeneca vaccine and after testing negative at home. It was only upon arrival in Japan that the positive test happened. It's the first detection so far of the virus in any incoming athletes, with 5 weeks still to go before the games. The member was denied entry into the country and was instead sent to a government-run facility while the rest of the team was able to head to Osaka. So there are a lot of concerns about how the Olympics are going to go. Of course, they were postponed last year thanks to the pandemic. Apparently, and this is actually the focus of one portion of John Oliver's program this week, the situation in terms of deaths is actually worse in Japan now than it was when the games were postponed last year. Which is, that's like one of the reasons I wanted to focus on this was, I don't know, I just sort of assumed that Japan would be doing better in this regard, but they're very much not. And this is going to be bringing in a lot of people from around the globe. They've, they've waived the required 2-week quarantine for international travelers for many Olympic teams. Athletes are gonna still be tested daily, which is good. There's been a lot of protests about continuing the games. And bear in mind, as of right now, Japan has only fully vaccinated 6.4% of their population. That is far below, for instance, the United States. And so I don't know, I really hope that they can manage this. I know that the world wants the Olympics to come back, David, but it does seem like a bad time to be flying people in from around the globe.
I'm with you, and that number 6.8% is just shocking. You would think that Japan would be much higher than that. I'm not sure where I come down on this, John, because I love the Olympics, and I don't want to deny American athletes from around the world the opportunity to go and compete against each other on the international stage in front of all the television cameras and do their thing. But I also get, you know, the people of Japan, they shouldn't have to be subjected to even wider coronavirus and variant spreads because of this. So I don't know where I come down on this. I mean, should the Olympics move forward? I mean, should we wait, John, a couple of weeks? I mean, where do you come down on this?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously they don't care what I think, but I hope that they're at least diligent in the testing. The fact that they detected this case, despite many reasons to believe that it wouldn't be there, is, I think, a good sign. If they're testing every athlete every day, And a lot of the sports are going to be in very large facilities if they can keep the crowds down. And by the way, just watch it on TV. You're going to have a much closer view of the athletes anyway on TV. So don't go. Don't go. Wait. It'll be in LA in like 8 years. You can come here. You can stay with me. We'll go to the Olympics. It'll be great. I want to see the Olympics. I miss the Olympics. I want to see gymnastics. It's going to be awesome. I want to see some fencing and stuff like that. But I just really hope that they can stop athletes from getting sick and that they can really quarantine them from the population at large, because more cases coming in is like the last thing that Japan actually needs. We'll see. Oh, and by the way, one of the things that I learned from John Oliver's segment on this was they can't, like, Japan can't actually stop it. Like, the contract they have with the IOC is that it's up to the IOC whether it goes forward or not. Isn't that weird? That like they can't stop the Olympics from happening?
Wow, that is strange. Yeah. And oh, by the way, so my wife, she keeps saying that she's looking forward to the swimmers and the divers. I don't understand why she's so focused on these guys with these little sort of bikini briefs and speedos. I don't know why she's so into that. I'll have to talk to her about it, but
you should. And you know, they should add a little bit more chlorine to those pools just in case situation's rough. Meanwhile, in Brazil, they are still dealing with one of the worst situations with COVID in the world right now. And we talk about this periodically, partially because for some reason, it just doesn't really get covered in the United States how bad it is there. We had this brief period where people acknowledged how bad the situation was in India about a month or two ago. But Brazil is really suffering. Their death toll just passed 500,000, the official death toll. God knows what it actually is. You know, we passed 600,000. In India, where it's also really bad, deaths may range from 600,000 to as many as 4.2 million. We certainly don't know now. We might not know for a long time. But in Brazil, it's really bad. Nearly 18 million people have been infected. They're averaging about 73,000 new cases and 2,000 deaths a day. I believe the last daily reporting was over 2,300 deaths, which is still terrible. Yes, 2,301, I think it was on Saturday. Only about 11% of residents are believed to be fully vaccinated. So they're apparently outdoing Japan, to reference one of our recent stories. And there have been massive protests over the past week about the current state. That hitting the 500,000 dead mark is going to inspire some people to expect some sort of change. And bear in mind, we've got next year an election coming. We've been talking about that recently. President Jair Bolsonaro has not been good on the pandemic. He called it a little flu, while refusing to follow or promote mask wearing, quarantines, and social distancing, despite having contracted the virus himself. He also encouraged large gatherings and disparaged vaccines. And I swear that paragraph is about Bolsonaro, not about Donald Trump, although every one of those facts is true, basically. Except with Trump, at least, the vaccines he disparaged were non-COVID vaccines. He seems to think you should take the COVID one at least. Oh, and by the way, in terms of international sporting events, last month, they announced that Brazil would be hosting the Copa America soccer tournament after Argentina said it would be too irresponsible to do it. It's worse in Brazil. They're going ahead. This could potentially have some effect, David, on the presidential election next year. But as of right now, at least, they are really suffering when it comes to COVID, and their government just doesn't really seem to care much.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction is my humanitarian empathy goes to everybody in Brazil, whether you're healthy or whether you're not. I mean, it is a horrible situation. It is terrifying. It was awful to see. I think the long view in all of this is that I think many years from now, people, particularly in political science, international relations, governmental studies, will look back and say, okay, there were several examples where incompetent leadership literally caused hundreds of thousands of people to lose their lives. And we're talking about democracies where there's incompetent leadership, not just Donald Trump in the United States, but Bolsonaro in Brazil. You can literally draw the connection now in both countries between a federal government, a federal response that is inept, that says, no, this isn't my responsibility. Everybody's on their own. Everybody, it's up to you to figure this out. It's up to states or provinces to figure this out. And that has been a disaster. And so there should be no argument about the connection now between competent leadership and how you prevent deaths in a public health crisis. And hopefully that's the lesson that we all take away from this and that generations will take away from this moving forward.
I hope so. It seems like a very small silver lining that at least if you preside over so many dead, you'll lose your job at least. So we'll see if that happens with Bolsonaro. We'll also see if you can potentially get the job back in a couple of years with Donald Trump. It seems like in a democracy, these sorts of things should matter, but we're gonna test that internationally over the next few years. That said, David, it has been a pleasure to have you on the program. That was a hell of a 90 minutes of news. Thank you so much.
John, where can thank you and appreciate everybody at TYT for including me. This has been great, a lot of fun and an honor to be on with you.
Great to have you here. Where can people see more of your content?
Rebel HQ on Facebook, YouTube, also as part of TYT. It's the channel where we put these videos up each day. Go to Rebel HQ and you'll see sort of my take in 3.5 to 4 minutes on some of the news of the day.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon. And for those of you watching at home, thank you so much for joining us. We got a big week planned for you, some fun guests. It's gonna be awesome. But the day is not over. In just a few minutes, if you head to youtube.com/indisputableTYT, Dr. Rashad Ritchie will be taking over. Gonna be having Greg Daniel of HBO's True Blood and Insecure guest on the show today. Kenya Evelyn is gonna be the co-host. You got Benji Backer, a conservative host. He has been on a tear debating these conservative hosts. So there's a lot to look forward to. youtube.com/indisputableTYT. For my part, thanks for watching. And until next time, stay safe out there, stay sane out there, and I'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.